to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Okay, well, I am delighted to be here, and I've put together sort of a series of points we can discuss. I'm really sort of open to just letting it go where we want to go. I think the main thing I want to do is get to the definition I'm trying to work with of legal infrastructure. That may be something we're all on the same page at immediately. It may not. I'm not sure. That's a bunch of stuff I'm sure will, for other audiences, I might spend more time on. And I will, as John mentioned, sort of end up with one of the key points that I'm thinking about, have been thinking about for some time in different ways, and that is the private production of legal systems. Okay, so there we go. Okay, so let me say a little bit about although the research agenda that this has come out of is thinking about the private production of legal systems. I started running the USC Southern California Innovation Project a few years ago, funded by Kauffman, another way that John and I have overlapped at USC. And one of the things I did there was the goal of the innovation project was to say, let's think about the legal environment other than intellectual property and how that affects innovation and the innovative enterprise. And one of the things that I've done in the course of developing the project there is go around and talk to general counsel, taking advantage of having been around Stanford, the Center for Advanced Study in 2006-2007, and sort of managed to get into a network of general counsel who would talk to me. And really just sort of wanted to explore with them what are the things that impact your capacity to be innovative in the legal environment. And it was very a very eye-opening series of talks and interviews and conversations and friendships that evolved from that. Just to give you a sense of who I've spoken to, Harvey Anderson, who's general counsel, these are all general counsel, I think Homsani is an associate general counsel, Harvey Anderson at Mozilla, Mark Chandler at Cisco, who you may have heard about, actually he's been very instrumental in trying to rethink legal professions and innovative settings. Kent Walker at Google, Ramzi Homsani, who's an associate general counsel at Google, Mitch Gaynor, general counsel at Juniper Networks, and Jonathan Anschel, who is at CBS and fellow UT grad. And what I heard from them, I mean, all general counsel, if you talk to them today, will complain about the high cost of legal services, spiraling expenditures, legal fees, hourly billing. Hourly billing is now making it to the front page of the New York Times. But what was really interesting about this set of conversations was that people were talking to me about not high costs per se, but rather what they couldn't buy in the legal market, the kinds of legal inputs for their enterprises that they just really found they couldn't find. So Harvey Anderson, for example, coined this term, which has got to show up in a title somewhere, of the DNA gap. Maybe it's one he's borrowing from a lot of places, but he said, look, our lawyers just really don't understand what our business is about. And so we get a lot of mismatched solutions. And he's tried very hard to get lawyers who will come spend time at Mozilla to learn more about the business, and actually says he has a tough time getting, and that may be something related to hourly billing, but the whole relationship is such, just getting people to come and spend time learning what the business is about. Harvey also talks quite a bit about the problem of transactional frictions, which we hear about from other general counsel as well. Mark Chandler, when I was asking him for a story, a number of these guys were on a panel that I put together a couple of years ago for the USC Intellectual Property Institute, tells a story in particular of in a setting where you'd expect that lawyers are doing a terrific job, which is, you know, large scale IP litigation. This he told a story in particular of a copyright litigation with a Chinese company, saying that he really had trouble finding litigators who knew how to think about strategy and litigation that was not limited to what was happening within the litigation itself. So, for example, they came in and said, you know, we think the first stage in this, we should bring some motions to dismiss. And Mark asked him, well, you know, are we going to win these motions? And they say, no, but it'll help us educate the judge and kind of lay the groundwork for what's coming. And he says, you don't realize I was on CNN the day this lawsuit was filed. You know, we lose those motions, and that's what's on all the news the next day, and that has impact on our investor community and so on. I need strategies that are taking account of the media and investor relations component of this and not thinking just in terms of of litigation strategy. Kent Walker talked about a lot about, again, these sort of these transactional frictions and contracting in particular. He sort of said, you know, we spend huge amounts of time and energy on contract drafting, dickering around with language, even though we all know it's hardly ever going to have any impact on our actual relationship. You know, he said in 10 years, we've never had a dispute turn on the language in a non-disclosure agreement. And yet, you know, massive amounts of time and energy spent putting it into that sort of thing. He's also saying that one of the difficulties they face with contracting, he thinks he's been trying to simplify things, send out a couple of pages that he thinks they're needed, and the other side chuckles and sends back, you know, 10 for every 2 that he sends out, and sort of, you know, the attachment to lots of language. Additionally, he's talking about the difficulty in designing contracts that, and somehow designing an incentive mechanism for, largely he's thinking is in-house lawyers, but also the outside lawyers, to recognize that we don't want to only reward, he's trying to figure out how do I reward not only the contracts that get drafted and what's in them and the problems that were avoided because there was stuff in them, right? But the deals that didn't happen or the deals that were less valuable because of excessive attention to risk, excessive attention to dickering over language and so on. He's trying to figure out how can he get that into the incentives for contracting within the firm and also with outside attorneys. His colleague Ramzi Homsani at Google, who helps with the YouTube project, he talked to me about, you know, just this wicked compliance problem of YouTube's in over 100 countries. I thought he had said 140. He said he's not sure it's 140. But anyway, it's lots and lots and lots, all with their own regulation for privacy, database, obscenity, copyright, and so on. And his point was that Google was developing the approach to how do you deal with that complex compliance problem in-house. And he said, what we'd like to be able to do was find providers out in the market who had a framework, experience, and knowledge to bring to that kind of overlapping problem, and they just couldn't find it, so that they ended up having to do it in-house to a much greater extent than they would have liked to. And I think this is actually a theme. We know that one of the things we're seeing in the legal profession is the growth of the in-house legal department. And I think that part of that's a consequence of trying to rein in the costs of the outside profession. But it seems that there's also a dynamic that it's coming from. There are certain things that we can only do in-house because, as Harvey Anderson's saying, the in-house lawyers do know a lot more about how this business works, that you can't go to the engineers and say, you know, here's our solution, and, you know, the salespeople or the finance people will be giving you a harder time internally. And so that the growth of the in-house legal department, I think, is in part also a signal. It's not necessarily the optimal relationship between inside and outside that we're seeing. These folks are saying they'd like to contract out more, and they're doing more on the make or buy decision. They're making more than they'd prefer. Mitch Gaynor, who is still running a pretty big business, it's a smaller business than, say, Cisco, one of the things he emphasized was the fact that, you know, I think he's been with the company since they were relatively small. They're now at $3.5 billion. But, you know, we were global from day one. Right out of the gates, we had people in, you know, team members in multiple countries. And it's not like the tradition, you know, the old style where you sort of build your international relationships and you've got a legal department and so on. So he's immediately got, also similar to Homsani, these, you know, wicked compliance problems. He's got employees in all these countries and so on. And he's got immediately to deal with the fact that he's got a cross-border team right from the start, right from the very startup phase. He's also emphasizing that group of collaborators, employees, team members worldwide who are collaborating seamlessly over the web for the most part. The thing he told me about is that trade is one of the topics that should be in the field of what aspects of the legal environment affect innovation, because he's saying these guys, you know, they work seamlessly over the web and then they throw the computer and the software in their backpack, get on the plane, and they get stopped at the border for transporting the, you know, the materials over the border, and it's creating he's got this trade problem. You know, again, complex, difficult set of problems, particularly for a company that at one point was significantly smaller. And I talking to also to Jonathan Anschel at CBS, I would have expected, there's no sense in which this is a scientific sampling of firms in the new economy or anything, but I sort of expected that CBS, I'd get a lot more conventional answers. You know, I'd want lower cost, but basically the system's working great for us. And even with respect to the types of things you'd think that the CBS has no trouble getting a perfect answer with, licenses for user-generated, for CBS content online and so on, you'd think they'd have no trouble getting the solution they want, which is, lock up the CBS content. But his complaint was that he couldn't find lawyers who knew to think about, this is my term, the economist term, the interior solution to those balancing the CBS ownership and the user rights to use in new media. That he would, the lawyers would come in first with kind of the draft that would just lock up the CBS content. And when he'd say, wait a second, we need to encourage users to participate in this system. And they'd go away, lawyers go away, and they'd come back, and they'd have kind of the user's dream set of terms of use, and that they didn't know how to think about where was that interior solution, which is, I think, something we can even relate to the excessive amounts of contracting. One of the things we know about the way a lot of lawyers work with contracting is they go look for the model, right? And those are the models that are out there. You can go find the one for locking up the content, and you can find the one that users design, but nobody's thinking about how do you solve the problem of getting the optimal level of ideas you can use and ideas that you're generating revenue from through protection over time. So this was a set of, I think, quite, for me anyway, quite eye-opening anecdotes about the difficulty of finding what's out there. Now, I'm not going to say anything about the world that these, to this audience, about the world that these GCs are living in, what is the new economy. We kind of think we're probably all on the same page, and I should have had dot, dot, dot at the bottom here. We've got a lot of other attributes here. But I think what we hear listening to these general counsel is stories about, and I'm going to relate to the notion of infrastructure, missing bridges and bumpy roads. The 10 pages instead of 2 is like a pothole that you're hitting on your route from A to B, and you're trying to get from A to B, and it'd be great if there was a bridge over that river there, and instead you're going through this expensive circuitous route, and there's places you just can't get to, and so on. That these are about connections, because so much of this is about how am I going to structure a set of relationships, and there's missing connections. And yes, they're talking about high cost, but I think it's really important to emphasize it's a lot of it is about missing legal inputs. What I want to focus on is how we can think about what these experiences with structuring legal relationships tells us about legal demand in the new economy, and how the changes in the economy are transforming the nature of legal demand. So one of the things I think is really important to notice is that in the new economy, where we've gone from kind of the box economy to the network economy, the world where everything happens inside, most of the stuff's happening inside, there's sort of discrete transactions across the bounding, to one where it's networked all through, that we have a lot of boundary crossing going on. And I mean here both crossing the boundary of the firm, so this is outsourcing and strategic alliances and sharing information with suppliers as Walmart does and so on. We have a tremendous increase in the amount of boundary crossing of the firm, as well as, of course, crossing boundaries of jurisdictions from a legal point of view, countries, which means multiple regulatory regimes. The number of the fact that we see, I don't know that anybody's actually looked at whether the number of contracts would go up necessarily. My guess is it probably goes up when you go from organizing within the box to across the boundaries of that box. If you have an individual employment relationship with everybody who's answering a phone within the firm, and now you outsource to a call center, right? Is that fewer contracts? But I think it's very clear that even if I suspect that the number has gone up, but I don't have any empirical basis for saying it. It's just a guess. Certainly, the complexity and the heterogeneity of those contracts has gone up. So we don't have the standardized, relatively simple employment contract or sales contract. The other thing is that we're seeing that given in a knowledge-based economy where the production of knowledge and competition in the production of knowledge is dominant, there's an increased demand for the integration of knowledge across fields. And that's the kind of thing, for example, that Mark Chandler's talking about when he says, I need somebody who knows how to think about litigation as a piece of a bigger strategy and not as a strategy on its own. And we're looking for integration across engineering, sales, finance, as well as law. The fact that the new economy is dominated by the notion of velocity and speed and rapid adaptation and things are changing means that our legal solutions depreciate more quickly, right? So whatever we thought we wanted for this relationship, the relationship looks pretty different. We're in a different relationship 6 months or a year down the road. And certainly if you talk to people in these environments, I mean, this is something we've known about business for a long time, that things never stay the same, but the rate at which that's true. So we predict from that our legal solutions, right, that what if the lawyer sits down to actually design something, is going to depreciate more quickly. Because there's much higher levels of heterogeneity, niche markets, multiple types of relationships, and so on, we're looking for more customized and novel solutions in the new economy than in the standardized old economy, and so we're looking for actually more of that design component in legal, there's a demand for that in the new economy. A lot of this adds up to also is in light of, I mean, the couple of things I just mentioned there suggest higher transaction costs, right? You know, you can't just kind of pull the standard contract off the shelf. You need something customized. You need to have more intelligence and specialization built into it. Perhaps it's not going to last as long. And at the same, so that's a higher transaction cost forces. But at the same time, it's probably the case, again, I'm making sort of predictions here, probably the case that the margins are smaller. And so, in fact, the tolerance for transaction costs is lower in the new economy. And that's sort of when Harvey Anderson at Mozilla or Kent Walker at Google are talking about, you know, we're just spending time on this. And Harvey would say this as well, you know, we're negotiating the deal. Everybody knows we all got to leave the room, let the lawyers spend a few hours or a few days or a few weeks, and then we'll get back to it. I think the tolerance for those transaction costs goes down from a number of for a number of reasons, having to do with intensified competition because of the expansion in the scope of global competition. With, you know, 20 years ago, 40% of the world wasn't participating in the market economy in the same way, because we have particular products or services that are operating at a smaller scale. They've got a shorter product life, so the tolerance for transaction costs is probably shrinking as well. Yeah.
I apologize just because I have to
let you
know that I want to just throw at this. Is this a description you're making of what law and legal structures ought to be in this complex framework, or something that you think is pushing down? Because
that's pushing down.
That's actually happening, and you're about to critique.
No. This I'm saying. I think this is what they're.
So I would like to then push back one question, which is, precisely under conditions of change and rapid change and complexity, a lot of systems gravitate toward relatively simple and low-content standard interfaces.
Yes.
And so why is it, for example, that I can see why the number, complexity, and heterogeneity of contacts increases.
Yes.
But I'm not sure whether that means that contracts should also be more numerous, complex, and heterogeneous. Or that more customized and novel, rather than that contracts move to a role that is simple and allows a lot of the things to happen within a trust-based relationship rather than within a legal device.
Yes. It's helpful to, this is the first time I presented these ideas, and it is because in fact I'm thinking a lot about the problem of complexity and the fact that we need simpler solutions. So Harvey Anderson is saying, you know, he's living in the soup of open source software. You know, why haven't we figured out how to reduce that? And that's what Walker's saying, is we want two pages, not. So yes, I think that's right. My list is sort of saying we have maybe number, complexity, heterogeneity of relationships has gone up, and whether or not that implies, therefore, 1,000-page contracts. I mean, but we're exactly on the same page with that. And that's actually related to this point about the lower transaction costs and so on. We can't afford to deal with it in the conventional way of, oh, that's off, that's not the off of the rack, therefore we'll pour high amounts of human capital and craft labor into it. And then, of course, I'm mostly focusing here on the nature of demand from the providers, but of course we have what's happening to the demand within the public sector as well, and we're looking at a world where we're probably thinking about much more dynamic models of regulation as well. It's regulating sort of under conditions of extreme uncertainty where we just don't know, you know, how do you regulate nanotechnology? How do you regulate genetically engineered foods when there's so significantly components of what we don't know, and we need to build our regulatory systems to develop that information, respond to that information rather than locking it down. So I just wanted to say, you know, I've sort of referenced a little bit here just to sort of put this in perspective against, you know, the old economy, the Alfred Chandler's sort of managerial enterprise. David Audrech and Roy Therick talked about the managed economy, you know, changing it to the entrepreneurial economy, where we, you know, dominated by scale economies, standardization, mass production, manufacturing, nationally structured. We have international, but it's international trade. It's production and regulation that's national and relatively stable. Obviously, there's change. These are relative statements, but relatively stable. And legal demand in that setting, as I said, is sort of most of the, since so much is going on within the box governed by what Oliver Williamson would call fiat within the firm, we're now crossing the boundary of the crossing of the boundary of the firm. There was largely sales, suppliers coming in, products going out. We have obviously finance, we have corporate governance, and that because we were talking about large scale entities and the real emphasis in regulation was on how do you manage the regulation of large, you know, oligopolistic or monopolistic markets, focuses on consolidation, vertical integration. So that's just to give a picture of, that's kind of the, you know, the last transformation was to that world, and in many ways law adapted to that world, and that's what I think we're out of step with, that we're now trying to manage our new economy with what I call legal infrastructure that's based on that old economy, standardized, large scale, etc. Now, I want to, this is the definition I wanted to get up of thinking about legal infrastructure. And this is a work in progress. I'm really looking forward to some comments on this. So one of the points about it is that legal infrastructure is available socially. I didn't want to call it social capital without putting it in parentheses because social capital has a lot of connotations to it. But I wanted to emphasize it was social capital in the sense it's what's lying around. So, for example, it's when you're drafting a non-disclosure agreement, the first thing lawyers will do is go look at what's lying around. What can I get online? What's in the old-fashioned file cabinets of the firm and the databases and so on? What's around? What are the procedures? How do we do this before? The reason there's lots of return to specialization for lawyers, it's what have you seen before? What strategies have you followed before? A lot of anecdotal knowledge and materials lying around. So it's available. It's capital that's available. It's socially available. They're capital assets, meaning they're producing services.
Is that mean, when you said it that way, I thought you were talking about like norms, a certain kind of classes of norms.
That's why I put it in parentheses.
Okay.
Let me get to the end, okay. And then we'll come back. No. We clearly have norms of trust and all those types of things in the background here. But there's still a lot we need to do. That's what I'm saying. This is for structuring or regulating relationships with legal rules. Now, again, I want to put legal in parentheses because part of the goal of this project is to destabilize the notion of law as that thing that orders relationships because it comes out of the state for the most part, right? But I do want to distinguish it, and this is where this is trying to figure out how to accomplish this, distinguishing, because I think we do, this is a little of our conversation in Santa Fe, do we want to fold law into all regulatory systems, including norms and so on, or do we want to preserve law as a component for law that is, to some extent, design-based, to some extent, not emergent, except we know it's going to have emergent qualities. So I put my parentheses and my and my quotes around legal and social, because I'm still trying to figure out where do we want to draw this line between we have norms of trust, fairness, reciprocity that are supporting a lot of interactions, but we also know there's a lot of law that gets added on top of that. We may have much greater components of our economy that are organized in that way for a variety of reasons, but there's any world in which we're talking about, you know, it will all be organized in that way. We're still going to have legal rules. The idea of, think of a contract, think of a regulation, think of a statute. I'm going to destabilize where those come from, but think of that as this is how we're going to proceed. This is what we're going to do. This is how you need to operate. Yes.
I would have thought that at this stage of everything up in the air,
yeah,
it would be valuable to split rather than lump things together analytically.
Yeah.
So when you say about, my intuition would be keep the legal separate from the
yes.
social norms. Keep the social norms that are, in some senses, domain specific, like how one enters into a contract, things about what
yes.
from the more higher, from the higher level
right.
conceptual things like reciprocity
yes.
And fairness, and find words for those. Even the social use, my intuition, just from listening to you, is that you probably, it might be productive to separate knowledge assets, which
mm.
are the forms, the thing that somebody has done before,
mm-hmm.
that are something you can reuse. The social assets, which are essentially a finding function. What, because it's not just any old form that exists, it's the form that the five friends I know can hand out to me. And the human capital assets,
yes.
which are the people who can bring judgment to bear. And each of those strikes me as a distinct form within capital assets.
Yes.
That have very important relationships and overlaps, etc. But that at least at this stage, it might be productive to keep them
yeah.
separate to see where the failures are.
Well, I think that's helpful. I mean, I'm going to give you sort of a way that I've sort of tried to divide it up here. But I think that that's helpful to get that feedback and thinking, because that was my instinct to say we don't want to kind of fold everything into. We don't want to say fairness is the same as a contract. And here, I'm sort of thinking about, there are some norms I want to think about as being part of our legal infrastructure, like the norms that lawyers employ. When you go and say, I want to set up a business, they say, okay, we have to do this. You know, I'm planning a wedding for this summer, and all of a sudden there's all these norms. Oh, well, you have to send invitations 2 months before, and you have to have seating like this, and you know, there's just all of a sudden I'm running into all these people of all these ideas about what I'm supposed to be doing, and so that's what we have with lawyers, right? You know, the you go in, they say, well, this is how you do that, and that practice, those norms I want to include. And so I wanted to define, I'll put them both up here, I won't keep you any secrets. I wanted to define, it was helpful, I thought, to think through a sort of a primary and a secondary legal infrastructure. And I'm trying to echo here for the lawyers in the room sort of the Hart's notion of primary and secondary rules. Primary rules, H.L.A. Hart, and the legal theorist for the law students as well. We have our primary rules, don't ride your bike in the park, and then we have our secondary rules, which are the rules for making rules. So I want to sort of think about, we have primary infrastructure, which is the stuff that we're using to structure that relationship. We're drawing on that contract, that norm, to resolve that dispute. And then we have the assets for creating those assets. We have the infrastructure that produces that infrastructure, right? And the reason I wanted to divide this out is partly because I was exactly realizing it was kind of folding in, that I want to be able to say, how is it that we are producing that primary infrastructure? Well, that's a function of our secondary infrastructure, which are things like legislatures make statutes, these kinds of legislations can make those kinds of statutes with these kinds of procedures, regulatory agencies, so the Administrative Procedure Act is sort of legal infrastructure for federal regulation, our institutions, the way our courts are set up. I've been writing recently about the difference between common law institutions and civil code institutions. The way judiciaries are set up, the procedures for introducing evidence, interpretive practices in courts. And that those aspects, again, legal regime is going to be too narrow to think about that. But these are the ways in which we define who can make rules. And secondly, and this can be quite important, organize and regulate the legal markets that are producing. So it's the legal markets that are producing the nature of the legal expertise that those general counsel are talking about they find when they go looking into the legal market. I want to find somebody who knows how to integrate litigation strategy with investor relations strategy. Right? Well, whether or not that's out there in the market is a function of how that legal market is operating. Right? Legal education. And then in the U.S. in particular, the fact that our organization of regulation of legal markets is quite closed. So that's let me get to that's the notion that the secondary is how we produce the primary. Like the rules for making rules tells us how we make the primary rules. Yeah, George.
I just want to pick up on the interface and how simple the interface or how much integration is necessary. So let's take that example you said about having a broader litigation strategy that's sensitive to the PR implications of it. So the question is, I think it's absolutely true that the client has to be informed about. But the question is whether it needs to be integrated in one person. I mean, that simple example to me looks like, I don't see why the lawyer needs to be the one to be aware of these things.
Yeah, I'm going to get Chandler to get in here and come tell the story.
Yeah, well, maybe he can speak for him. You know, so the lawyer can simply say, look, we're thinking of going to apply for summary judgment. We think our prospects are these. And then the client would then bring the PR expert to say, well, you got these costs. So that's my question.
It's perfect because that's related to why does the lawyer have to understand the business? Why do they need to know something? And it's not necessarily part of it is the person, right? There is a large craft component, but part of it is the service, right? So it could be the combination of people who are participating, right? We know that litigation strategy was actually the product of people sitting around a table like this, but all the people in the room were lawyers, and all the people in the firm are lawyers. And most of the experts in the counsel that they're talking to are also lawyers, right? The firm is not actually combining it. It could be that the lawyer is going but is not producing a service that's been produced in an integrated way. I think some of it does have to be integrated. But I think part of that is I think the conventional way of thinking about legal services is you tell me what your legal problem is, right? You're the business person, right? I will tell you what the legal aspects of that are, and you will then make decisions about how they fit in. But if I can produce a much higher quality legal product for you, right? So if I'm the in-house lawyer and I know it's just not on to run the risk of being on CNN the next day, having lost, right? I mean, that's just obvious to me for perhaps as an insider. I don't devise that legal strategy in the same way. That's expensive, costly process for doing that. Anyway, so impress on that. Oliver.
As you lay this out here, I'm wondering, are you running the risk of doing, analytically, the risk that you just described of the lawyer giving advice?
Huh.
Because this is a very deeply legalistic format for understanding the problem, and it's very traditional. And I'm wondering, again, would it be more sensible as you set up an analysis of this to turn around and look at it from the client standpoint rather than from being a lawyer's standpoint? Anyway, that's a very inchoate notion. But I'm just wondering whether you know that in effect you're going to a solution space first rather than to the problem space first, and I think that's what you're saying, that the one of the problems with the lawyers is they come in and say, oh, well, here's
so I hadn't got to the solution stage yet.
Okay.
That was really just saying I just want to sort of be able to define some terms of what we will find out there.
Okay.
We will find something called primary. We'll find something called secondary.
I'm attributing what I should.
So then you're just anticipating where my next slide is going, which is the production process. Or do you want me to take your question now, or do you want me to?
I have it's a clarification question.
Okay.
So the legal infrastructure that you are talking about, is this an all-purpose legal infrastructure, or is this a very specific legal infrastructure kind of design? To address the new economy situation, or is it like the legal infrastructure as the legal system? Is it sector specific, kind of?
So I'm not actually designing anything here. I am not saying we need a primary the infrastructure that looks like this and a secondary that looks like this. Right now, I'm just saying, in if we're thinking about, I think, any, you know, limited market economy, right, there are legal inputs that are required to structure that. And there's a, and in order for that to be, for an economy to be productive, efficient, effective, and so on, it will help if there are capital assets, legal assets, that are available so that when you and I decide we want to do a deal, we don't have to invent everything ourselves. But right now, there's nothing here about whether it would be sector-specific, but that's kind of what I'm going to get to, which is that our real question is, how do we produce the primary legal infrastructure? And that would kind of go to your question. Okay. Is it produced sector-specific? Is it, you know, economy-wide and so on?
My question was triggered because you started with a particular sample, a couple examples of
the general counsels, yes, yes.
And now it seems to me you're describing more broadly with good reasons.
Yes. Yeah, so the general counsel, we're saying, we're in innovative industries, here's what we're facing. And I'm saying, look, what we're talking about is, you know, we know there's a significant transformation in the economy going on, and we haven't transformed the nature of our legal infrastructure to meet the demands of that new economy. And these people are just out there on the margin of it. They're having the bigger problems with it, right? They're seeing it more and more. They're the ones who are seeing more of the missing bridges and so on, because they're trying to do things differently, right? The paper bag manufacturer is pretty much grinding through, and I'm doing some field research now with a postdoc at USC, and that's what she's finding is, you know, when she goes talks to the paper bag manufacturer, they're still talking what Macaulay was talking about in 1963, you know, oh, standardized, da-da-da, but, you know, you go talk to the telecom or the cell phone manufacturer, and you're hearing these kinds of stories. So now thinking about the secondary legal infrastructure, remember, which is sort of the installed base that produces the primary legal infrastructure, that produces the contract materials, the norms, the practices, the levels of expertise you'll find in your legal services sector. And the main story here is that this is really dominated by monopoly production methods. Most of our legal rules are the product of state entities, right? Politically governed, deliberative, voting bodies for the most part, agencies operating under delegation from statute, right, with those kinds of procedures, and judiciaries. A lot of our rules, particularly in the U.S., are produced by judiciaries, rules of evidence, rules of procedure, some substantive rules of, say, contract damages, and of course, common law adaptation of law over time, so that the rulemaking entities, for the most part, are state as opposed to private entities. Right. So,
but only at the secondary level.
What I'm saying now, I'm describing the legal regime that produces rules. Right.
Because at the primary level, it is.
Yes, that's right. The contracts are written.
The freedom of contract, the freedom of business organization, the freedom of finance.
Yes.
It's actually almost unlimited.
Well, that's my point. Is actually it's not. It's heavily conditioned by what's available. So
that's
it's heavily,
okay.
Yeah, heavily.
Yeah,
and then so then we've got our legal markets, which are also, they are private, right? You have to pay for that lawyer. It's a market transaction to hire a lawyer, more so in the U.S. than anywhere else, I think. But they're, for the most part, it's a closed profession. You have to get a JD, be a member of a bar, operate within within the states where you have admissions to the bar. In order to provide inputs in this market. And I've got a paper that goes into a fair bit on this, and I won't go into a lot more detail on this right here, except to say so that we have this fairly insulated group of people that we educate at places like the law school here. Everybody's got the same training. Everybody works in organizations where mostly they talk to people who are trained exactly the same way as them. So, you know, what's a fundamental notion of how we get creativity and innovation? It's diversity. We have very little diversity, intellectual diversity in the setting. So maybe that's coming back to George's question about, you know, they're sitting around the room, a bunch of lawyers, to think about what's the litigation strategy. They're not sitting in the room brainstorming with the non-lawyers as well. And the non-lawyers are not thinking about how to solve these fundamental problems. How can we use some large-scale data analysis to predict what will happen if we put that provision in the contract or not, or whether it really matters, whether we have, you know, the advice is you got to sign that NDA. You know, where's the empirical data that says it's worth it? I think if you ran the study, and Google could run the study, right? But why can't they? The norms are they just can't do it. They can't do it.
They're horrible, too.
Yeah, and you got to go to lunch. You got to sign it. Yes, sir.
I think everyone's comfortable with legislators and agencies and judiciaries making laws. But when you move beyond that to whether it's going to be your traders or stock exchanges making rules to foster economic growth, I mean, it seems troublesome for me. The question comes up, is that even law? If it's not the state that's doing it, and would a broader, what's a broader, more inclusive definition of law that you could work with, like something?
Well, there's a difference between, I want to distinguish, you sort of just anticipate where I'm going on this thing. I think we need much more, I've got the wrong one up here. It's not. Hang on a second. There we go. That we need more competitive production of rules. This is a little bit of getting to, you know, to what extent is it for this field versus that? Because currently, right now, right, when the state produces it, it tends to be economy-wide. So our law of evidence, our law of procedure, our basic contract rules, and so on, are often economy. Sometimes you can get some sector adaptation. But I think we clearly don't have the optimal level of adaptation there, which is not to say, for Yochai's point, that, you know, more complexity and so on, that in some sense we want less complexity. A lot of settings you want less complexity. But I do want to think about the potential for private rule production here, and that's different from let Wall Street regulate itself. Okay? So my goal in this project is to say we need to be thinking about how can we get more market-based production in there. That's not the same as saying there won't be a need for settings where we can't accomplish that because we're not really, right, there's law to structure purely the private relationship. So if you want to think about the contract between the two corporations, where there's really almost nothing there at stake except the efficacy and productivity of that relationship. Right? We can still regulate it. We can still say you can't pollute the air and so on. But from the point of view of what kind of contract law should they have, right? There's really no reason to say why don't we have private firms producing that? Why isn't there Hadfield Inc. saying, you know, bring me your deal. I've got a better, cheaper, more predictable, better adaptive, more adaptive method for managing your relationship. Why do you want a contract? Well, risk allocation, commitment. Right? Well, okay, there's lots of ways we could solve those problems with underlying, serve those functions. And that the method of hire lawyers, have them draft paper, say in the paper what you intend, be bound to what you intend, and then fight it out as soon as things start to diverge. I think there's lots of alternative possible solutions that could be technological, that could be collaborative, different combination of services, et cetera, et cetera. So you could just bring me your deal, the two of you, right? Bring me your deal. That's different from saying, so what's the way to solve the problem of securities regulation? But it's very clear from the financial crisis that we're just continuing to press on a model, right, of public production of that. And part of this is saying, you know, we haven't done it yet. I don't know exactly what the solution is. Part of the point about saying we need to harness more market incentives for this is because it's hard. And that's why there would be big returns for somebody figuring out how to do it. But we need to figure out a way to get more bottom-up methods of the development, the production of those sets of rules and procedures into the process, because we're in a world now where the idea that you can educate, right, that these public entities operating with public sector incentives to develop that system, I just think we're just hitting the point where that's largely unsustainable. That's, I think, what we're seeing. I think it's just, you know, it's getting ready to implode, and that's why, you know, how many pages, thousands of pages in the bailout bill, and, you know, hundreds of pages. At some point, we're just past the point at which any of this is making a mockery of the idea of a rule of law or structure, right? I said this at this conference with John recently. Markets, I think, can do a little bit. If you can figure out how to structure the market, right? Markets should do a better job of figuring out how to simplify and get optimal levels of complexity into our structures. So I think that's the, I'll just throw up my conclusions here and then, I was going to talk about open innovation, but I'm not. So I think my key message is, first of all, to say we need to recognize that legal inputs are economic inputs. There are legal inputs that are not economic inputs, that structure our democratic institutions and protect rights and so on. But I'm carving off a world here of saying, in terms of structuring markets, legal inputs are economic inputs, and therefore legal policy, again, in this field, is economic policy. Right now, all that policy is being made by lawyers and judges who aren't really policymakers and don't really have the institutions and processes for making economic policy. And that an economy dominated by these features of adaptation, networks, knowledge, novelty, heterogeneity, this is kind of the exploding material that it's dealing with. We just need to find a way for more bottom-up market-based methods of producing those economic inputs, which are kind of the rules and structures. And that's where I think the public component is setting the secondary legal infrastructure that then controls, structures, the processes, the markets, and no, it won't be entirely markets. There's no sense in which is this, you know, all market-based, but we need to look for more methods for that.
Thank you very much. We can open up for questions.
Oliver.
I'm very broadly in accord with your conclusions and very happy with where you're aiming it. The places that I would suggest some comments is more in the middle of the analysis, in a sense, where, for instance, I think it's good to remember that there are reasons why some of these apparently nonsensical things exist.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, I'm an old transaction lawyer. I used to do deals. And part of what you describe in terms of the whole transaction cost is not just, I think, rent seeking by a bunch of silly lawyers, but rather, in fact, actually combines a signaling content with a trial marriage. You can signal your intention to be bound and to be respectful to a relationship by running up costs. In the natural world, there are things like the bowerbirds, you can build all these funny things. And one of the ways you can do it is the peacock stuff. You run up costs, and this demonstrates your fitness, could be also your commitment into this thing. So the fact that we have a lawyer ritual, actually your marriage ritual, I think, was actually quite apropos. That we have a marriage ritual as well. Why do we have all of this fancy stuff around the marriage? Because it helps in friendship. It's a demonstration of commitment. It is a demonstration. It's also, quite frankly, it's like visiting the family. The long drawn out negotiation is the corporate equivalent of making sure that you've been through a stressful undertaking with potential for opposition together. That all of which it needn't determine, but I'm just saying all of which has actually some value in the ritual. And yes, it may be that we want to jettison the ritual, but I think if we jettison the ritual, I think we also need to understand what we're jettisoning with it, besides a lot of time and paying lawyers to.
So my only point here, right, I'm saying I think we're hearing, you know, I'd be willing to, the old dollars to donuts, that we have an excess of all that stuff. But my point here is to say, the determination, right, the way lawyers decide that right now is deliberative intellectual exercise. Right? And so if we have an ABA committee, right, or a rules revision committee, right, it's having this conversation kind of at this, but it's not outcome based, it's not evidence based, it's not market based, right? The point is the answer to that question you're posing is, it requires intensive amounts of information processing in lots of different settings. It's going to vary from, like, so the, you know, the big deal for, so this is the point about Juniper Networks, right? Yeah, okay, maybe that's fine for when AT&T is going into multiple countries to do it that way, but when Juniper Networks is just trying to get off the ground, right? And they can't buy that process. And so my main point is that it's just ludicrous to think that we could sit around a table and decide what the optimal structure is.
The other piece I would go with is, although yes, there are etiquettes in various transaction
right.
styles and things that lead to large agreements. Also, when I was a transactional lawyer, I had my hyper agreement, my mid-range agreement, and my two-pager.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually was very much guided by my client's wishes and desires in which of these would come to the fore in which context.
Right.
And I think that the current secondary rule set actually is very permissive of my two pager. And if anything, it's in the culture at the front end, which is where
right. And I guess I'm saying you can't.
The piece I would go with is, although yes, there are etiquettes in various transaction
right.
styles and things that lead to large agreements. Also, when I was a transactional lawyer, I had my hyper agreement, my mid-range agreement, and my two pager.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually was very much guided by my client's wishes and desires in which of these would come to the fore in which context.
Right.
And I think that the current secondary rule set actually is very permissive of my two-pager. And if anything, it's in the culture at the front end, which is where
right. And I guess I'm saying you can't identify. It's very difficult to identify the feedback mechanism. We can. The only way we're really answering that question, or the way you're reaching it, is through your anecdotal experience,
right.
your judgment, which is obviously a highly valuable.
But,
that's
but,
what
but my anecdotal experience also was one where I encountered no legal limitation. Now, I was in a particular industry, and in other industries I may have.
Right.
If I'd been in the securities regulation
right.
industry, it would have been a very different matter. I was in the entertainment business, and one could be napkin deals, and they would be what
yeah.
you had to. But I'm just saying again that from my I never bumped into a secondary rulemaking limit on my ability to be the lawyer that you want, which I applaud.
Right.
Those folks wanted to be. I just never did.
Right.
The piece I would go with is, although yes, there are etiquettes in various transaction
right.
styles and things that lead to large agreements. Also, when I was a transactional lawyer, I had my hyper agreement, my mid-range agreement, and my two-pager.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually was very much guided by my client's wishes and desires in which of these would come to the fore in which context.
Right.
And I think that the current secondary rule set actually is very permissive of my two-pager. And if anything, it's in the culture at the front end, which is where
right. And I guess I'm saying you can't identify. It's very difficult to identify the feedback mechanism.